Hi there, it's Sarah, host of Trending Globally. Before we start, I wanted to mention something. We're trying to learn more about our listeners, what you like about our podcasts at Watson, what you don't, and what you'd like to hear more of. So we created a survey, and we'd love to hear from you. It only takes a few minutes to fill out, and it will really help us improve the show. And you'll be entered into a raffle for a pair of Bose noise-canceling headphones. A link to the survey is in our show description. You can even go fill it out right now. We'll still be here when you get back. Thanks. Now, on to the show. From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Sarah Baldwin. Whether we're thinking about parenting, pregnancy, or public health, Brown economist Emily Oster likes to challenge conventional wisdom.
People like different parts of the research process. That's the part I like the best, is like the moment when you find something that nobody else knows, and then it's like a fact that you know and other people don't know. That's very exciting.
One of Oster's most recent papers, posted at the National Bureau of Economic Research, is about a subject that's full of conventional wisdom, the American diet. Oster challenges how doctors and scientists create those studies we read about in the newspapers, the ones that tell us that kale's good, sugar's bad, and red wine is somehow both. I spoke with her about where she finds inspiration for her research and about what it's like growing up in a family of economists. I started, though, by asking how she first decided to study the world of science and nutrition.
I noticed that, and I think we all noticed, that there are a lot of health recommendations that come out. So if you open the New York Times, you'll see, you know, oh, this week it's good to eat kale, next week it's good to drink coffee, the week after no coffee. And so I'm interested in how people react to those. And I had in mind the following idea, that say we tell people to eat kale. So we start, we say, oh, by the way, it turns out kale is really good for you. And we want to think about who are the people who are going to start eating kale in response to that. And one feature is those are probably the people who are doing a lot of other positive health behaviors, who are doing other things to help their weight stay down or help their heart health be better. And so then one of the things we rely on in science as we go forward is when you get more data, you know, you will learn more about some relationship. But an example like this, actually, things may kind of work against you, because what happens after you say kale is good is that a bunch of people start eating kale who are doing a lot of other positive behaviors. So then when you come back again and you say, okay, now let me study kale again, now that I kind of already have the theory that it's good, and maybe I'll find out that it's not good. In fact, you probably will find out it's not only good, but even better than you thought it was, because the kind of people who are newly adopted kale are very sort of, as we would say, positively selected. They're people who are doing other things.
So it's sort of self-perpetuating?
It's self-perpetuating.
And socioeconomic status is a piece of this, right?
Yeah. So I think that when you think about, when I say things like people who are selected, yeah, what I mean is things like socioeconomic status. So the people who newly adopt health behaviors tend to be higher education or higher income than others. They tend to do other positive health behaviors.
Do we know the why for that? Because I think we accept that and we go, mm-hmm. But why does that make sense? Does it make sense?
I think that in economics, there's kind of two theories for that. One is that people who are more educated or higher income have kind of higher, we'd say, like lifetime earnings. And so their incentive to invest in their health and live longer is higher because they're richer. That's a sort of standard, like neoclassical model for investment. I think the other story that people tell, which maybe resonates better as a person, is that people who are more educated have a better sense of what is good for them. And so it's easier to understand what are the kinds of steps that you would take.
And to avail themselves, right?
So the last thing I would say is that there's also just a pure resource story, which is, you know, richer, more educated people have more time on average. So in paper, what I try to do is sort of take that kind of anecdote that I told about kale, and I try to look for that in the data. And so ask in some particular context around diet and in this case, vitamins, whether we actually see these kind of cycles that I've described. Do we see that when we change the recommendations, some kinds of people adopt those behaviors more than others? And then do we see those differences in adoption show up in differences in, say, the relationship between these behaviors and health as we go forward in time?
So what do we do with your conclusion? What do we do with your findings?
So it's a little bit of what I would say like a negative paper, because in some sense I start by saying that we sort of know if we take any individual point in time that when we try to look at the relationship between something like, you know, eating a low sugar diet and weight, we know that we're already going to be contending with the fact that the people who eat less sugar are kind of different than people who don't, and it's going to be hard to adjust for that. This paper says that that problem is, it's even worse because it is not static. So it isn't like in any moment the relationship is just a bit too high or a bit too low, but it's always the same amount too high or too low. This says that the degree to which that differs from the true effect is varying over time. So in the case of, say, sugar and weight, if you look at data, and this is one of the things they do in the paper, if you look in data from, say, the early 1990s, actually people who eat more sugar tend to be a bit thinner. You know, not a lot thinner, but the relationship with weight is negative, or with BMI is negative. When you then look at that in, say, 2013, the relationship is hugely positive. So there's like a huge change in not just the magnitude, but the sign of the relationship because of these changes in selection. And you can see that sort of very clearly in the data.
So in a way, it's sort of the message is be cautious about what you think the data are showing.
So, you know, I talk a little bit about this in the paper because I think you're kind of highlighting what is, I would say, unhelpful or discouraging, which is, this is just a paper about, oh, we can never learn anything about, don't just give up. And so I think that's not quite what it says. But so I try in the paper to talk a little bit about whether we can use some of those changes in selection in a kind of formal way to come to some conclusions. And the basic idea there is to say that, you know, we take the example of sugar and weight. We see one kind of regime of the world, one version of the world where there's less of a relationship between sugar consumption and education or income, and one version of the world where there's more of a relationship between sugar and education and income. And we can kind of ask, what's the real effect of sugar that would make both of those facts true? Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, there is something to that broad idea that we could use these data to kind of get to the truth, even though the thing that we're seeing in the data is that, in fact, we're further from the truth, or it's worse than you thought, or however you want to take that.
Yeah, well, no, and I don't think I was receiving it as negative information, but I was looking for the, and therefore, and it's sort of not there.
Yeah. So this paper is mostly about, look, you might have thought this fact was true or not. And it is kind of true that we see these cycles. And I think the other thing, which is, again, not constructive, is that in a lot of the academic literature on this, people tend to think, oh, OK, well, I understand that I'll have this problem, but it's fine because I'm going to control for things. And we're always liking to say that we control for things, which really just means we adjust for some sort of basic variables like education, income, maybe race. And when you do that here, it basically makes almost no difference.
Yeah, it's a little disorienting. You're used to sort of certainty. And this is like, what is knowable?
Yeah, I think about this all the time in the context of diet, because I think our information on diet and kind of what works is so poor. And, you know, a lot of it comes from studies of the kind that I'm sort of picking on is the wrong word, but of the kinds that I'm highlighting the limitations of here, which are these observational studies. I think one thing people have said when I've given this paper a lot is, okay, does this just mean we can only have randomized control trials? This just says, so that's the only solution. And I think in some sense that is a conclusion you might draw. On the other hand, trials are expensive. And, you know, if you want the answer to, like, is kale good for your heart, you're not going to run a trial on kale.
Right.
It's just, you're just not like that. Right. Nobody's going to fund that. That's not going to happen. You couldn't get people to eat the kale anyway. Like, it's just like there's 1,000 problems. And so we really are going to be relying on these kind of data, which says, you know, we have to be realistic about their limitations. And I think really try to figure out, well, what can we do? You know, we knew that there are problems at any given time point. Now we know that those problems are dynamic and, you know, getting worse in some periods than others. How can we use that to make progress? And I don't think I really have quite the answer.
Mm-hmm. But when you think about studies that you read about and health recommendations in your own life, do you just sort of roll your eyes, or do you think, well, I better stop drinking coffee right away? Or
I would say this paper is largely motivated by my father, who is a person who does all kinds of crazy health stuff. You know, he's like one of those people, he's putting the chia seeds in his orange juice. He's like having his fish oil. I mean, he's very like, my father also has a PhD. He's also an economist. He is in some ways a very skeptical person, but he sort of really buys into some of these things. And so I think about that a lot in when I think about what kind of people who are adopting these particular behaviors. I mean, I tend to be pretty skeptical about any one-off relationship. And I think that's something that a lot of people share. I'm probably also more skeptical even about pretty like large scale kind of findings that are taken as received wisdom, because some of them are just really not, you know, well supported. And, you know, there are some that are. So I think things like the, you know, the Mediterranean diet, that's something where we do have some like randomized data suggesting that it is a good idea. So I think there's sort of a few things there. And there's a sort of broad sense in which I think we know that like eating a diet exclusively made up of like Doritos and potato chips and soda is like probably not good for you. But the distance between like exclusively eating Doritos and soda is bad for you and like you should eat chia seeds and, you know, this particular and dandelion greens, like that's a wide gulf. And, you know, understanding, you know, where in there is something we sort of know and where is not, I think is really hard.
Well, that brings me to your work in general. There's such a variety of subjects, but often health related, vaccines, babies, pregnancy myths. What about health questions is interesting to you as an economist?
So I will say I've always been very interested in health even before I was an economist. So I've always been sort of, I thought I would be a doctor. That is a longstanding interest. I think in particular with a lot of these recent projects, I am really interested in information and how people think about information and process recommendations and the times in which they don't do the things that we think that they should. And I think in some ways that's sort of very deeply steeped in economics because our economic theories tell us one thing and we look at the world, often behaviors are very different than we expect.
So give me an example.
So, you know, theory would say that when you get diagnosed with a metabolic disease, where if you lost a bunch of weight, you would not have that disease, that you would lose a bunch of weight, because we tend to think that sort of we have other information suggesting that people value their life and they like to, you know, live for a long time. And by not losing weight, you are implicitly accepting a lower life expectancy. And yet people do not do that. So I have some work that basically shows that like you diagnose people with diabetes, they make very, very, very minimal changes to their diet, mm-hmm. even though that is a huge part of kind of living a healthy lifestyle with diabetes. And we see all kinds of things. People don't take their medication when they're supposed to. And, you know, people don't get the kind of genetic testing that we think that they should. They don't get the flu shot. Like there's sort of tons of things where people are not doing health behaviors that economists would think are optimal. Mm-hmm. And I think that understanding those deviations and are they systematic and what kinds of theories do we need to understand them, I think that is sort of very steeped in economics.
Is that how you come up with your ideas for research? Like, I want to find out about that because someone you know has a curious behavior that might be explained in economic terms?
Yeah. I mean, I like the idea that now everyone I know is going to be like, oh, are you watching me for weird behaviors? Yeah. I mean, I think that I get a lot of ideas from sort of looking at behaviors, not necessarily of the people around me, although sometimes the people around me. And, you know, in particular in this sort of work that I've done lately, of which this is sort of a piece, which is kind of about methodology. I think a lot of that has been motivated by some of the work that I've done studying sort of the health literature and pregnancy and pediatrics, just sort of thinking about some of the differences between that literature and what we do in economics and sort of thinking about the limitations of our approaches and limitations of their approaches and you know, how we can use techniques across disciplines to try to improve what we can learn from data.
You said your father has a PhD in economics and your mother's an economist as well. So you were sort of raised in this ecosystem of economists. Were you raised as an economist? Were you raised to see the world a certain way or to ask a certain kind of question or to look at information and data a certain way?
I mean, I think probably yes, we're always raised in these ways, even if we don't know. You know, I think the thing that really permeated my childhood that I can remember very vividly is some of these sort of basic concepts from like microeconomics, which I now teach, were kind of a thing that you just like talked about in your everyday
life.
Like
what?
Okay, like, mom, why do you get your groceries delivered instead of going shopping like everyone else? Well, my opportunity cost of time is very high.
Oh, okay.
Like that. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And like that wasn't like, you know, let me teach you about opportunity cost. That was like, that's the answer to the question.
Got it.
Like, mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, okay. Yes, I understand. That's mm-hmm. that's the answer to the question. Mm-hmm. And so The other one I remember is my father. We used to give him a hard time about not changing lanes aggressively enough at tolls. Right. So you're waiting for the toll and sometimes one line seems fast. And then we'd be like, why don't you get that line fast? He's like, this is a no arbitrage condition. You know, it's none of the lanes can be faster than any of the other lanes, which is, just to be clear, patently false.
Okay.
About toll lanes.
Phew, okay.
Definitely not right. But it was sort of things like that. So you kind of pick up those things. I mean, I'm not the same kind of economist, like the same subfield as my parents. So it isn't quite like I learned what they do. But I think this basic vocabulary, it permeates.
You looked at so many recommendations, negative, positive, in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, in Science Magazine, or the Journal, and then all these different kinds of food, berries and pineapples.
Somehow
all that turns into these equations, Roman and Greek letters, and that are quite upsetting to look at for someone who is not at home in a math setting. So, has that always made sense to you? I mean, do you just love to change information into symbols and equations?
No, I will tell you something. No.
Oh, really?
What I like is the pictures. I like graphs.
You like graphs?
I love graphs. Mm-hmm. I like when you can see your results in graphs. Mm-hmm. That's what I like. Mm-hmm. I am not a person who does a lot of that kind of theory. And so you are not the only one in this podcast who doesn't find that to be the favorite part of the paper.
That's a relief. I actually pulled all those off, but you're talking about at the back with the...
Yeah, the graphs with the dots.
Yeah.
Yep, where
so
you
many,
can sort of see
so
things
yes.
going. And, you know, then you can sort of explain, okay, I'm looking in this graph for things moving for the two series to be moving together.
Right.
And I think that's something you can see. Then you may ask the question, why do I have all that math if I don't like it and neither do you? And I think it in this case, so the particular thing that's sort of drawn out in the math in the paper is to sort of try to understand when we would expect to see dynamics like this and when we would not. So the example that I always give is about toothbrushing. The dynamics in this paper require that when the behavior is suggested, when something comes out as a healthy, good health behavior, the people who adopt it are kind of healthier than the people who don't. In the toothbrushing example, you can say, well, what would happen if all of a sudden a study came out that said it's really important to brush your teeth once a day? Well, if that, say that changed some people's behavior, well, most of the sort of otherwise healthy people are already brushing their teeth at least once a day. So the people who would be sort of newly brought into toothbrushing by that would actually probably be sort of negatively selected. People who are otherwise less healthy, because the healthy people are already doing this.
Right.
So then this kind of dynamic that I'm talking about is not going to happen. In contrast to if we all of a sudden had a thing that said, actually, it's really important to brush your teeth three times a day, who would be the first people like dragging their toothbrushes to
They're
lunch?
Already, right.
It would be the people who are doing
They're brushing
the
twice a day anyway.
Exactly. So mm-hmm. I think that sort of what the math actually illustrates is that there are situations in which you'd expect to see these kind of cyclical dynamics and situations in which you would not.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of comes out in the math.
Like, I know how as a writer, I see that, like, I interpret the world maybe in clauses or, you know, yeah. adjectives, and you maybe see the world as pattern or numbers.
I mean, I see the world as data, I guess, is how I would say it. So some people in economics will start with the model, they'll start with the math. I start with the data, and, you know, I sit down and I basically made some pictures, made some graphs in the data, and sort of then pretty quickly see, okay, actually it does kind of look like there's something here. And then of course it's a long way from that to a paper, but that's the thing I like the best. So if you sort of, people like different parts of the research process, that's the part I like the best, is like the moment when you find something that nobody else knows and then it's like a fact that you know and other people don't know. That's very exciting.
Emily, this was
great thank
conversation.
You so much.
Thanks for coming in
thank
today.
Thank you for having me.
This episode of Trending Globally was produced by Dan Richards, John Mazza, and Alex LaFerriere. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. I'm your host, Sarah Baldwin. Before you go, don't forget to fill out our listener survey. There's a link in the show description for this episode. You can fill it out on your phone right now. It's really short, and we'd really appreciate it. And you'll be entered to win a pair of Bose noise-canceling headphones, which will make all your podcasts sound even better. You can subscribe to Trending Globally on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another episode of Trending Globally.